Marshall here. Welcome back to Counterbalance. Mike is still in Central Asia. He will be back next week, so I'm sure we're going to have plenty of things to talk about. I'm really excited to discuss his trip, what he's learned, and at least figure out a little more about a region of the world you don't see in U.S. foreign policy discussions that often. But I'm continuing to hold down the fort solo, and I'm bringing on one of my favorite Hudson Institute colleagues, Rebecca Heinrichs. She is a senior fellow at Hudson, and she specializes in U.S. national defense policy with a real focus on strategic deterrence. This is actually the second time I speak with Rebecca on a podcast at Hudson. She came on The Realignment in late 2019 to discuss a talk she gave at the Oxford Union around the origins and meaning of President Trump's foreign policy perspective. It was great to talk with her over a year later to see how she thinks the end of the Trump administration played out, what the meaning of that foreign policy approach is, and how it really contrasts with the Biden administration's approach to many of the same questions. There's so much here. So, pretty straightforward. With all that, let's dive into the episode. Of course, a huge thanks to Hudson Institute for supporting our work. If you'd like to learn more about the Counterbalance podcast or the work of my colleagues such as Rebecca, you can go to hudson.org to learn more. Rebecca Heinrichs, welcome to Counterbalance.
So happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. This is the second time that we've spoken on a podcast in a Hudson context, and it was a really fascinating conversation. I suggest everyone go back and take a look at it at The Realignment. We were really focused on your just really excellent articulation of Trump's foreign policy and why it really matters at a deeper level than headline of the week. It really stemmed from a speech you gave at the Oxford Union, I believe, in 2019. So something I would love to do is, we recorded that back in late 2019. I would just love for you to update where your thinking is regarding what you were discussing, especially given your argument that this all means something deeper than just one presidency. This is about a broader reorientation of American foreign policy.
Great. Yeah. So sort of, you know, the broad principle here for what I saw was unique about the Trump approach to world affairs is, you know, he was notoriously this populist president, but, you know, intuitively, Donald Trump kind of had a Team USA jersey on. So he was out there to compete. He wanted the United States to succeed. He didn't really buy these arguments about parity, about international organizations being where we worked things out globally, that the United States really had to be a strong economic power, a strong military power, and work hard and fight for American interests. And so if that's sort of your intuition, it has all kinds of policy ramifications. And so it really was the Trump era that got the United States on sounder footing versus the greatest geopolitical threat facing the American people and the American way of life, which comes from the Chinese Communist Party. And the other thing about Donald Trump personally and his personality was he really was not deterred by these ideas. Well, sir, we've never done this before, and you're going to upset all of these people if we do it this way. That didn't really resonate with him. And so it actually worked out well. We were able to do a lot of things that presidents in the past were afraid to do, you know, moving the American embassy to Jerusalem in Israel, even though it's wildly popular in the United States. Sort of the conventional wisdom in the national security community is that if you do that, you're going to create this crisis that's going to spill out over the Middle East. Well, that didn't happen. Or pulling out of the INF treaty because the Russians were cheating on it. This was something people were like, well, it's better to just have the treaty there, even if the Russians are cheating. Well, Trump was like, well, the Russians are cheating. Why are we party to a treaty where we're the only ones that are abiding by it? So we pull out of that treaty, and now we can build those kinds of missiles that the treaty prohibited in the past to deter China. So, so it really got us on sounder footing to do what we need to do here decades after the Cold War, where we're no longer sitting at the apex of American relative military and economic power relative to our adversaries, which is China, and then secondarily the Russian Federation. So that was what was different about the Trump administration. Not to say that everything worked out well, and Trump's own personality flaws and, you know, definitely got in the way sometime of that very good, I think, intuition and impulse. And he wasn't able to carry out and execute a lot of things that needed to be done. But that gets to your point that you made to me, which is one that, you know, I think is so true, is there's something fundamental here that exists kind of beyond Trump the man, that future presidents can pick up the ball and run with it too, and continue this new era of American foreign policy that works out much better to protect the American people and defend our interests.
There's so much there that I want to pull out. I want to start with this. A lot happened in the year plus since we recorded, and obviously COVID is that big thing. And I think one of the most important effects of COVID on the international system has really just been the delegitimization of a lot of international institutions, especially the WHO. And this was the type of thing where if we're testing whether or not these inclinations and ideas are just in the moment or are going to last longer, I think the WHO's failure and the real lack of credibility it has, even on a bipartisan basis, is a good example of that. So how would you say the discourse around like multilateral institutions really sort of stays right now? Because my thesis would basically be that without COVID, it would have been much easier just to, let's say Biden had still won, come into office and say, we're going to rejoin all these things and everything is hunky-dory. But it doesn't feel like we're in that state right now. So I'd love to hear what you think about that.
No, that's great. And that's actually a great subject to dig into that explains kind of what I just said about what was different about the previous administration, because the WHO is something that really brought this point home. It's a corrupt organization. So it's a multilateral organization, but simply by being multilateral didn't make it work well. And it didn't serve its sole purpose well, which is to help mitigate the problems of sickness, global sickness, and to help global health. It didn't do that. And it gets back to these fundamental problems that we have, which is different countries have different interests, and they don't all operate the same way that Western countries do, the way that the United States does, with transparency and accountability and all of those other things. And so the WHO is just a classic example of a corrupted multilateral organization. And this Biden notion, these sort of liberal internationalists, these Joe Biden's, many people in his administration who say, well, the United States has to be a player in order to fix it, in order to make it work better. They say that, and it sounds nice theoretically, but we haven't done it. We've been the largest financial contributor to the WHO and have been unsuccessful in solving the huge problems that continue to exist. So what I said was, during the Trump administration, when I was talking with officials privately, I said, let's pull out of the WHO and just put our money towards other world health initiatives and then have people join it based on their responsibility and what they're already doing that's conducive to helping solve the problem, and let Taiwan, for instance, be the first member. So it's not that I'm saying all multilateral, you know, institutions are bad, but we've kind of lulled ourselves bipartisan consensus, kind of this notion that just being party to these multilateral institutions is good in and of itself. And the fact of the matter is, it's just not true. I mean, the Paris Climate Accord's another example of that. The UN Human Rights Council, it's just a cudgel to use to beat up Israel. And it wasn't serving its purpose. It's a joke. It has human rights abusers that sit on that council. And so, Nikki Haley kind of famously, pulled the United States out of that. Well, the Biden administration comes in showing how different they think about these things and rejoined. And so there are some fundamental differences between, the Biden administration and the Obama administration too. Those, they're different, but they're much more similar in contrast to the last 4 years of the Trump administration.
I love you bringing up the Human Rights Council and the WHO, because there's a really interesting dichotomy there. So we can just both agree, who cares about the UN Human Rights Council? It is just silly. There's very low stakes there. Put that to the side for a second. When it comes to the WHO, however, when we play devil's advocate and say, what if the case isn't that, what if there's not an affirmative case? So to your point, it's not that, oh, we can reform and do all these great things with it. But what if there's a negative case in the sense of just ceding these type of international institutions to, like you said, great rivals like China? So what if it's not that, let me make the realist case. And the realist case would say, look, Rebecca, I totally agree with you. All these problems in the WHO, a worse version of the WHO is one that's effectively just been completely ceded. So how would you respond to that argument?
I would say that I haven't really seen any evidence that the United States has had any positive effect at all. And so if you have a rotted to the core organization that's really being subsidized by the American taxpayers, it's much better to just cut it loose, and that the United States being party to it gives it much greater legitimacy than it deserves. And so what we should be doing is, in my view, pulling out of it and then just stigmatizing it. This is what Xi Jinping has said, that the China way is better than the liberal democratic way, than the way that the U.S.-led order that has been the U.S.-led order since, World War II, the Cold War, apex of American power, that it just hasn't worked out and China can do it better. We've seen, because of the coronavirus pandemic, a little glimpse of what a China-led order would look like. In terms of its dishonesty, lack of transparency, disappearing doctors, not providing information we need in order to mitigate the disasters of this virus, et cetera. And that will really be the organization without the United States, this sort of, stigmatized WHO. And if we present one that's different, with higher standards that you have to meet to be party to it, with world-class doctors and scientists that we have, it will provide a greater contrast. And of course, I think that the hope would be eventually that that other rotten Chinese-led WHO would just shrivel up and die, because countries are going to want one that's functioning and actually works well. And so I think that's the route we should be going. And again, though, the Biden administration didn't even try, though. They didn't even try to reform it. They just said, let's just get back into it and see how it works out. And we know how it'll work out. It'll be the same organization, but just funded by the American taxpayer.
Yeah. And this leads to, I think, one of the fairer critiques of where Trumpian excess didn't put the country in the greatest place, just conversations around alliances. Because when you're making the case against a pretty clear and rather obvious case, I think, against multilateral institutions, the obvious counter is we should focus on alliances and we should do this, 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 and that to accomplish the goals that these multilateral institutions really coast on having. Obviously, the WHO, world health is important. No one's disagreeing about that. So the counter would be, let's lose alliances and new. So how would you assess the state of America's alliances? And what would you say would be the lessons from the Trump administration when it comes to the mix of, I think, accomplishment, but also probably rhetorical frustration and failure?
Yeah. So I would say, in my dream world, where you take what was really good about the Trumpian instinct, a greater emphasis on American sovereignty and strength, which is just a correction from these over-reliance on globalism or multilateral institutions. You know, you take that, but then you then personality-wise, you have somebody who understands, though, that the United States does not, again, sit uncontested. We've got two major powers contesting the United States in multiple theaters. We need allies. We need allies and partners to be strong, to have strong defenses, and to cooperate with the United States in ways that we simply cannot possibly compete and successfully weaken China and come out on top without the cooperation of our European allies on all kinds of things, and then also, absolutely, our allies in the Indo-Pacific theater, Japan and Australia, even India, South Korea. Obviously, I think it's at Japan, which I think is the cornerstone there, ally. So, you know, Trump was right to kind of shake our allies, especially when you think of like Western Europeans, that they have to act like allies. The United States cannot continue to subsidize their own security while they strike up trade deals, energy deals with the Russian Federation, while the United States invests so much money to deter Poland and our other NATO allies against Russia, that it's actually harming the NATO alliance. Trump was right to beat the table about that. Where I think it was not good is that there was not, I mean, Secretary Pompeo made the case well, but he was one person. It would have been better if we had had a coordinated messaging explaining why we're pushing our allies to get stronger. It's not because we don't need them anymore. It's because we do need them. And so, you know, I've just been frustrated that the media just covers it as though, like, you know, the last 4 years, the United States hasn't worked with allies, and now the Biden administration is going to work with allies. We did work with allies during the Trump administration. You know, we really worked with allies in the Quad, you know, Australia and Japan, to deter China, to start working on especially in the hard power piece to deter China. But the president's very public kind of browbeating of allies, in particular on trade, I think drowned out other positive messaging that was going on. And so now, you know, all the media reporting is about how Joe Biden is now working with allies, when in fact he's just ceding all this leverage that Trump built up to try to get our allies and partners to cooperate with us better and spend more money on the things that they ought to help the U.S.-led order. And so now I'm kind of seeing all of that just being squandered away in, you know, as Joe Biden gets ready to meet with Vladimir Putin in the next week or so.
Yeah, so that's actually a great pivot to the other rival country you've really focused your work on, which is just Russia. How would you say things stand in June 2021 regarding the U.S.-Russia relationship?
Gosh, it's terrible. I mean, things are so bad right now with Russia. And the thing is, I mean, Joe Biden, we know a lot about Joe Biden's foreign policy because he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you know, whenever he was in the Senate. He was the vice president of the United States. He's spoken in many different forums and on the Senate floor. So we've got a pretty good handle on how he thinks about things. And so does Vladimir Putin. And so, you know, it's not a secret that Joe Biden is really soft and, again, sort of instinctively really puts a lot of his hope and trust in treaties and agreements and these multilateral institutions at the expense of hard power. And so, you know, you were just as Joe Biden is going into this meeting with Vladimir Putin, he waives congressionally mandated sanctions on the energy pipeline, Nord Stream 2, that goes from Russia to Germany, that really harms the NATO alliance. And so, it's just a huge concession going into this meeting with Vladimir Putin. At the same time, if you just look at the span of the last couple of months, you know, you've got Russian hackers that are hacking American beef supply chains and the Colonial Pipeline, American energy. That those are hackers that comes out of Russia, which Russia, at the very least, the government would have to give tacit approval, if not outright help and support to something so major of such strategic consequence. you know, we could go on with some of the things that that the Rus- that we think, you know, the Russians are participating in, but it's not good. And so it, it is probably, it's a very low point right now. And, you know, I think the only way we get our footing again is to come, you know, come at them with strength. Vladimir Putin understands strength, and we're just not seeing that coming out of the Biden administration.
And what would strength look like?
More significant defense budget. We have the rollout of just the top line of the Biden defense budget. And you would think now, if everybody's agreeing, we're now not just contesting one major power, the Chinese Communist Party, but we have the Russian Federation, and we want to deter conflict. We don't want to fight conflict. You would see a significant increase in defense spending. We're not. It's basically flatlined. While domestic spending is just ballooning, I mean, trillions of dollars. So it's not as though we're like tightening the belt, our belt here. We're not just, you know, trying to have more responsible spending. It's domestic spending is ballooning while we have these major powers contesting the United States. And then I would be slapping major sanctions on Russia for not helping the United States, or for not doing more to clamp down on these cyber attacks coming out of the Russian Federation. We've known that this has been happening for a long time. I definitely would say absolutely not are we going to waive sanctions on Nord Stream 2. Even if they move forward with it sort of just like over our dead body, are we going to do that? That this is something that is terrible for the NATO alliance. And you set these, you know, these markers down going into the meeting. And instead, I just don't really understand what Joe Biden thinks he's going to accomplish in meeting with Putin at this point. He's already made this huge concession and pretty much has looked the other way on these, in terms of blaming the Russian government for these cyber attacks against American supply chains.
So I like how you laid out a framework conceptualization of how President Trump approached foreign policy. And you've alluded to this during the conversation, but do you have a good thesis around how you think the Biden approach is, how he's conceiving of, and even just the people around him too? Because I think in both presidencies, these are ones where the figures who are around the president are of incredible importance too.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there, I think that there are different schools of thought on different issues, kind of pulling for who's going to win the day with inside the Biden administration. You have those really lofty idealists like, you know, Samantha Power type people who, you know, are emphasizing, you know, we just need to really elevate democracy and fight autocracy, which of course you don't, that's not the way it works. We have countries and regimes, and you want the good guys, the United States, to come out on top. And so you have to do real life things to deter them and to prepare to fight and win if deterrence fails. And so anyway, you have those more kind of idealist types. And then you have those who are saying, oh my goodness, the Chinese might take Taiwan, and that would be a disaster. And so you've got some China specialists who are very serious and who are working hard to do good things and so and to maintain some continuity from the previous administration. I think that there's a sort of a couple of warring groups inside there. I think even those folks that I would consider more serious and more realist, if I sat down and had a conversation with them, I'm sure that we disagreed on some major, big, more philosophical points about American defense and foreign policy. But I do hope that they're the ones that can have more influence over the next 4 years just to kind of like stop the bleeding, of which I think this administration is really going to carry out over the next 4 years. I mean, I think the Middle East is going to be the worst, but if the China realists in there can, at least realists as far as more liberal Democrats go, if they can win the day with Biden on China, that we could do a lot worse. So that would be the ideal, I think.
Yeah, and we focused a lot on the Middle East here, so I think those arguments are pretty clear. But from your perspective, what is the argument that's happening between the realists who you're friendlier towards and the folks who are disagreeing? Like, what does that argument look like?
So there are some people who still believe, and this, I really believe this is Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden on the campaign trail. Remember the famous, infamous now, you know, China's going to eat our lunch, man. China's not going to eat our lunch. Those are like just these old, they still think that, you know, that the American, if we just be America and have global trade, that our ideas will win the day and these other countries are just not going to do as well, which we have had decades to demonstrate that that's not necessarily the case, that sometimes it's the United States that weakens and the authoritarian country that enriches itself and invests in the world's largest navy, which is what China has done because of being integrated into the global economy. And so you have those people who still believe that we can have some kind of normal trade relationship with the Chinese government. And then you have others who are saying, no, we cannot. They're literally committing genocide. And so we have to be working to weaken China in all of these ways without, if we can avoid it, without escalating it into a worse conflict. And so, I mean, I think that those conversations are ongoing, and I don't think there's been a conclusive decision about which direction they're going to go. It's probably going to be a lot of pulling and tugging over the next, like I said, several years. But again, Joe Biden himself is very representative of those who just very recently was saying that China is not our number one geopolitical foe, that it's a necessary trade partner.
Something I'm really curious about as we're nearing the end here is these ideas, especially at the start of the episode, talking about Trump's instinctual approach. Could you talk about how moving forward, regardless of candidates and individuals, President Trump's relationship with the presidency in 2024. How do you see, as you perceive Washington, how do you perceive those instincts filtering in to the, let's just say, the center right to conservative foreign policy establishment, to the political leaders who aspire to the presidency? How do you just see that those instincts coalescing, moving away from all that stuff?
I mean, my, you know, some of my full transparency, some of my favorite politicians in terms of how they handled the Trump era was, you know, Tom Cotton has handled this very well. So we'll just kind of talk about him for just a minute, which is that you have to see what's going on with the country. You have to care about what the American people are saying about defense and foreign policy to the extent that they are talking about it. You can't just ignore them. And I really think over the Trump era has reasserted caring a lot about what the American people are saying, which is sometimes often not what the elites in Washington, D.C. are saying. And I think that that has had a real, Hawley is another one. Senator Cruz is another one. Even Senator Cornyn. I mean, some of these senators are picking up in defense and foreign policy and making these pro-sovereignty, pro-American strength, and understanding that we don't have to be afraid. It's not Chicken Little. Like, if we make these big changes, these big necessary changes to regain American preeminence in the global context we find ourselves in, the sky is not going to fall. We can do this, and America just has to lead. I think that has had a very positive impact on the Republican Party in that way. Where we mess up is just thinking that all of the great things that did happen because of the good instincts that Trump had as a more populist outsider president, conflating that with all of his personal character issues that were, I think, very divisive. And so not being able to pull those apart is tripping up some members of Congress and thinking that we can just kind of write off the last 4 years, everything about it was bad and terrible, and need to go back to the way things were. So that, I think, is still being worked out inside the Republican Party. And it is certainly my hope. And part of that's, you know, at the end of the Trump administration, I think there was a great opportunity to lay out very clearly the accomplishments in foreign policy, the Abraham Accords, and why those came about, why it was so important to get on sounder footing versus China, all of those things that were good, strengthening NATO, for all of the Russia, Russia, Russia stuff, NATO was in a better position after 4 years of Trump, if you look at the hard powered economically, than now what we're seeing with Joe Biden coming in and then waiving sanctions on for Nord Stream 2. So I hope that moving forward, we can see what was good and different about the last 4 years of the Trump administration and take the good of it, the meat of it, and apply it. We can't leave without just saying, too, on the Middle East, understanding that it's not that Americans are unwilling to go to war or to fight for our country or to fight for American security. It's that we want to understand that these are wars that are necessary, that are winnable, that we have a plan, that we're thinking clearly about it, and that we're not going to fight protracted wars without end. And I think that's something too. You have a lot of, you know, Republicans and grew up hearing about peace through strength and thinking that means that anytime there's a fight that someone's picking with us, we have to fight that one, but we have to be prudent and understand that the American people, the ones that are going to be signing up and fighting in these wars, should have a say in which wars are just and necessary and good. And so it is my hope that that's going to be something that the next, you know, president who understands the good that came out of the last 4 years of the Trump administration can pick that up and run with it in a way so that we have a smarter American defense and foreign policy that meets the needs of today and fights for American preeminence rather than just kind of acquiesces and is just fine with parity with adversarial countries like the Chinese Communist Party.
So last question that relates more to your Hudson Scholar work. How is there anything that's upcoming that listeners should take a look at? Any topics, conversations, anything like that?
So I've got a couple of big, a couple of essays I'm doing for a couple of organizations. One I'm working on for the Heritage Foundation puts out a really big publication on military index and strength. And I'm just turned in my first draft of this report on just the likelihood now of nuclear conflict. It's actually gone up since the Cold War, but just in different ways. So, you know, when we think of, oh my goodness, nuclear employment, that would be Armageddon. Well, no, not necessarily. At least it wouldn't start out that way. You can have conventional wars, meaning non-nuclear wars, start out in a regional context that are small, but escalate when the stakes are very high, which is a big concern about Russia against our Eastern Central European NATO allies. I'm worried that Russia might think, because of the direction and the weakness of NATO, that if they pop off a low-yield nuclear weapon, that the United States and NATO would simply let them have what they want rather than risk escalating that. Or China over Taiwan. You know, Taiwan is the unsinkable aircraft carrier. If we allow the Chinese government to seize Taiwan, I can go over all the different terrible, the symbolism there would be awful, but also the real no kidding geopolitical consequences of that would be a disaster. And I think that would be the deal breaker in the end of the American-led world order. And then there'd be all kinds of subsequent negative things. The United States wouldn't be able to credibly live up to our security commitments to the Japanese, to the Australians, if we don't have access to the Indo-Pacific theater. So when you have the stakes that are that high, the risks of a nuclear employment go up, even if it starts off in a non-nuclear contest. And so I'm concerned about it, but there's things that the United States can do if we recognize that well to adapt our nuclear deterrent, to seek to disabuse our adversaries of the notion that employing a nuclear weapon of whatever yield would ever be worth the cost, and that the United States will defend our vital interests, and we should be clear about what those are. And I think right now we're too vague, and being vague on these points can tempt aggression in a way that would be a disaster for the United States and our posterity.
Really well said. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on Counterbalance. Look forward to next time we chat.
Thank you so much. Look forward to another one.
Hope you enjoyed the episode. As I mentioned, Mike is going to be back next week, so he will have plenty to discuss with all of you. Of course, huge thank you to Hudson for supporting the podcast. We'll see you all next time.